Celebrate America's 250th with Dish. For a limited time, get an extra $250 off when you sign up. Call 888-ADD-DISH or visit dish.com today and use code DISH250 to claim your $250 savings. That's 888-ADD-DISH. Offer ends August 12th. Terms apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. It's hosted by me, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, an organization and community devoted to these very themes. Hello. During this episode of Memento Morbid, if any names, books, ideas, or artworks spark your curiosity, check out the podcast show notes for more. You'll also find a link to our Substack, which contains imagery discussed and additional content. Today, I am thrilled to be talking with an old friend and a photographer whose work I very much admire.
There was this one medium, and his name is Gordon Garforth, and he told me at his seance I would see his hand get really big, and I went to his seance and I actually did see his hand get really big. And to this day, I don't know what happened there. And I got my picture actually, you know, it's my picture is actually scarier than what I saw.
Before we bring in our guest, let's enjoy a listener's story, question, or encounter revolving around death positivity.
This is Sophie from Monmouth. My husband, Sam, is a fireman, so he would work night shifts. And I never used to sleep properly when Sam wasn't there. Living in our old house in Monmouth, lots of strange things started to happen. For example, I'd be cooking in the kitchen and something would drop onto the floor. Lights would just come on randomly in the middle of the night. I'd go down, switch them off, go back to sleep. And then a couple of hours later, I'd get back up again and the lights would be back on. My dog at the time would go to a particular corner of our living room and just stare and bark at absolutely nothing. Lots of strange things would happen. And in the end, it got to the point where I was really anxious. So luckily, there was a vicar that lived opposite us and we explained it to him. And he came and blessed us and blessed the house. He then gave us a little wooden cross and told us to put it in the room with the most activity. So we put it in the living room in the corner where the dog used to go and bark. That particular night that the cross was put in there, Sam was on nights. The lights came on in the middle of the night. This time I was just like, do you know what? I'm just going to stay upstairs. I waited for Sam to come home from work. He went into the living room to turn the lights off. And then he went over to the corner because he noticed that the wooden cross wasn't in the bottom of the windowsill. It was actually wedged halfway up in the window. The only way that that wooden cross could, you know, be in that position is if somebody had put it there with force. Someone who lived in the house many years ago said they experienced same things. I didn't want to dig any deeper because I didn't want to know, to be honest. However, it did make us sell the house and move. I didn't believe in any of that sort of thing before, afterlife. But honestly, there's no other explanation for what went on in that house.
Thank you so much. If you have your own offering, a reflection, memory, or encounter that you'd like to share, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. Today, I am thrilled to be talking with an old friend and a photographer whose work I very much admire, Shannon Taggart. Shannon is best known for her decades-long exploration of spiritualism, which is a 19th century American religious movement focused on communication with the souls of the dead.
This body of work is collected in her 2022 book, Seance, which is a beautiful and fascinating book. Her work has been published by major outlets, including Time, Newsweek, New York Times Magazine, and the Wall Street Journal, and her work has been exhibited internationally and been celebrated with a number of awards. Shannon has also given many talks and produced many events for Morbid Anatomy over the years, and even contributed a beautifully illustrated essay to our Morbid Anatomy anthology, and I'm thrilled to have her today on the show. Welcome, Shannon.
Thank you. Seems like old times.
I know, only with more tech. So I've never formally interviewed you before, but I kind of wanted to start with your background as a photographer and wondering who were your main influences when you learned about photography and decided that's what you wanted to dedicate your life to?
Well, I can actually attribute it to a soul photographer, Deanne Arbus. I remember in high school, I was studying photography and our teacher showed us her images and it was like I saw what photography was for the first time, which to me seemed to be you could show people your thoughts, or you could talk without words, or you could use reality to say something about reality, and felt very metaphysical and very not how I had ever seen it before. I finally understood it as an art form. And I was just saying this to somebody recently. I asked kind of, who's your favorite artist? And the person said, oh, I don't do favorites. And I was like, I am still stuck on Arbus. I feel like I've finally gotten to a place where I understand it better. But yeah, so that was my first love in photography.
I love what you said, the quote of using reality to talk about reality. And I think that speaks to something so interesting in your own work that we're going to get to a little bit later. But I just love how you put that. And I had never thought about it in exactly those words. So my next question is, how did you first learn about Lily Dale and the religion of spiritualism?
So I grew up in Buffalo, New York, which is not far from Lily Dale, which is the world's largest spiritualist community. And my cousin, when I was in around the same time, actually, when I found photography, my cousin went to Lily Dale and got this message from a medium there about how our grandfather died. And it turned out to be this weird family story that was true that none of us knew, which is that he had a choking incident rather than died of brain cancer, as we all thought. And it was very shocking because I remember, you know, my family being really kind of taken aback by it. And I just thought, like, how could a total stranger know something like that? It was an anonymous setting, meaning like when you go to a message service at Lily Dale, you don't put your name down. And I know there are stories of mediums looking up people's information, but it wasn't that type of a situation. It was actually a very uncanny, somehow this woman had perceived that information in a way that we don't understand.
And do you think you could just backtrack a little bit for folks who might not know what a medium is or what a message circle is and kind of explain, yeah, like, what is Lily Dale and what did you experience there?
Yeah. Spiritualism is a new religious movement started in America. It's based on the idea that we can speak with spirits of the dead. They have these sessions called seances. If you're aware of, let's say, the mediums on TV, like such as the Long Island Medium, they're just talking in a room with lights on and there's nothing strange or there's no kind of ritual going on. But in seances, the lights are out. You know, sometimes they use a red light. You often have the box, like the medium's cabinet where the medium will sit. People are sat in a circle. And when I would photograph these things, I would get a chair and I would have my camera on a tripod and you're not allowed to move around, you know, so I was just beholden to my seat, but also beholden to the lighting situation, which is often dim, very dim if they have lights on at all. I have also done infrared photography in seance situations where it's completely dark, but there's an infrared light on that you can't see. So I focus before. So it's very experimental. And I never know what's going to happen. And, you know, I don't know what my camera's going to pick up and I don't know what I'm going to see either. Because seance situations are also like sensory deprivation situations. You know, your eyes, when you do see a light and it's low red light, your eye kind of tries to make sense of the situation and fills in blanks. And it's almost like a good way to describe it. It can be like a psychedelic experience without drugs. You start to trip out a little bit. My photography had to be kind of experimental in those situations. And some of my pictures are straightforward, but a lot of times I have to use time exposures. And that's breaking the rules of documentary photography. But I also started to see it as oddly appropriate because one of the primary elements of like a paranormal experience is that time behaves differently. And part of the reason my project became this gigantic inquiry, I mean, I'm still like knee deep in it, is because I realized that spiritualism, it was a big part of culture and it was deeply tied to innovation. And wherever you find 19th century innovation, you also find spiritualism. And I had never heard of it. And growing up in upstate New York, it was actually near this area called the Burned Over District, where Mormonism and spiritualism and the Seventh-day Adventists and the women's rights movement, all these radical new progressive movements began. And it wasn't really talked about. I mean, still to this day, it's not that common knowledge. It had been written out of so many histories. And it was really in my face because I had grown up in the area. And, you know, I went to college in Rochester and I grew up in Buffalo, and I did not know any of this cultural history.
And do you think part of the reason this has been written out is like a sort of embarrassment? Like people don't quite know what to do with this, especially because, as you said, it's tied up with so much that we admire.
Yeah, I think it troubles the materialist history of modernism, of culture. I just saw this talk by the artist Michael Carter, and he had this great line where it's like, there is no modernism without the new age. And he wasn't talking about the new age of the 70s. He was talking about spiritualism and then theosophy. And then, well, yeah, what I discovered is it's not only that it influenced innovation, it influenced the most innovative of the innovation. You know, even now, an example you can see that's very in our face in culture is how the history of abstraction is being rewritten with the mediumistic artists like Hilma af Klint and Georgiana Houghton. But even recently, I discovered I was doing a talk for the College of Psychic Studies, and there's an artist named James Tunney, and he did an interview about how Francis Bacon, his three panels for the crucifixion, the first one is inspired by an ectoplasm picture. And so this is not just a painting, this is a painting that changed the history of painting. Like, there was painting before this painting and painting after this painting. I think there's
Wow.
an art historian who famously said that.
Wait, can I interrupt you real quickly? Just for our listeners who might not know what ectoplasm is, do you want to describe a little bit about ectoplasm?
Oh gosh, we're gonna get really down the rabbit hole if I
We have
go
to,
down
though.
that.
We have to. You can't just throw ectoplasm out. You got it. I was gonna, it was a question I was gonna ask you down the line anyway, so you've just preempted it.
So ectoplasm is this substance that is seen in a lot of the early spiritualist photographs. It's kind of part spiritual, part material. It's shape shifting. It looks like cheesecloth or constructions of like fake constructions. It looks very fake in the images, but spiritualists believe that it was this substance that bridged the realm between life and death, and it's part of their iconography. Well, I'll just get back to the Eva C. point, which was that this picture, it's very obvious. There's no denying that this picture obviously inspired the first panel of this painting, but that Francis Bacon lived 1,000 feet from the College of Psychic Studies.
Really?
So, yeah, we did it on a map. It was 0.1 miles. It's just fascinating to me. I keep finding new and interesting things, but the fact that spiritualism and photography were deeply entwined was shocking to me because, you know, I went to photo school and we studied the history extensively. I didn't go to any photo school. I went to RIT, which is like the mecca of photo schools. I mean, there was like five different majors of photography and we studied the history inside and out. And it wasn't in any of the history books that we had. I did later find one book in the library,
One
but
book.
that was literally the first book ever written on it, which is a book called Beyond Light and Shadow by Ralph Krauss. And it didn't come out until the 90s. I mean, I was in college in the late 90s, and it wasn't even published, I think, until 1996 in English. What I came to realize was that spiritualism was a religious movement that used photography to build an iconography. So in like Catholicism, you have painting that, is one of the big vehicles of getting the ideas out visually. And spiritualism used photography. And this ectoplasm it's like a mythic substance. It's like the teachings of spiritualism in these images made with this ectoplasm, which is that life and death remain connected, and death can insert itself into the material realm, and that we have powers to contact the other side. And I couldn't believe it. And so I guess what I'm saying too, by finding the Francis Bacon thing, it was kind of like a vindicating moment, like, oh my God, like this is way bigger than we were led to believe.
Yeah. What I really love as someone who loves history and the history of material culture and visual imagery is how much you do bring the history of this art form into both your practice and your thinking about the work.
Yeah, I like to say that it's one of the uniquely unsettling moments in all of the history. Like when I saw those pictures, I found them shocking in a way that nothing else was shocking. And yes, I find them tender and oddly beautiful and grotesque, and they just were deeply disturbing and unsettling in a way that I could not wrap my brain around. I had seen war photographs, of course, and you see pictures of extreme poverty or extreme situations or even really provocative images, but nothing kind of affected my brain and my heart the way that these pictures did. And I knew that there was something more to them, and I just couldn't understand. And they were so gross too. And
Yeah. And I wonder how many years have you been now doing this series on spiritualism in Lilydale?
well, I started in June or July 2001. So
Wow.
it's like 25 years. And I mean, I'm just as shocked as anybody, but I guess it's a testimony to how rich the topic is. And part of my practice has even become saving the history that I do come across, because so much gets thrown away. It's just considered pseudoscientific debris or, just bad, worthless material. Because when I'm talking about like the idea to use photography to prove, okay, so spiritualism, it's not just religion. It's trying to merge religion and science and philosophy into one all-encompassing system. And they don't even really believe that talking to the dead is necessarily supernatural. It's more preternatural, or just part of a scientific worldview that we just haven't put together the pieces of yet.
Yeah, hearing you talk about that reminds me too of we did an exhibition together at the Morbid Anatomy Museum many years ago now about magic. There were plenty of very good reasons to bring spiritualism in. We weren't overreaching because many of these early magic shows really played on these ideas about talking to the dead. And was that really possible? Was it trickery? Was it science? What was going on there? I remember we took great pains in that exhibition to write that panel that kind of talked about all the scientific discoveries going on at that time. And that's one thing I always think about with this, at a time when suddenly people could look under a microscope and see a world that until then had been completely unimaginable, or use a telescope or use an X-ray to see within the body. Suddenly, all of these invisible worlds were coming to light in really unexpected ways. And it kind of seemed to me, as we were doing that research, almost like, of course, if we can do all these other things, why couldn't we talk to the dead too? Right? There's something so logical about it as well, which kind of, to me, makes sense of how it ends up being a scientific pursuit at that time. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess the story goes that, oh, these gullible people, they thought they could see ghosts, and then it was proved that they couldn't. But the way I look at it now is that the way we look at the world is so literal, and that, true things aren't necessarily a fact, and that spiritualism was speaking to this intuitive level of knowing that the dead and the living remain connected. And so I guess it's more appropriate to see it, spirit photography, as like a mask, a ritual mask, or something like that. And even, I guess I could say probably many spiritualists I know would argue against that, and a lot of spiritualists still are really pursuing the scientific proof, but I kind of look at it different. And also, I see spiritualism now as kind of this eruption of shamanism in Western materialist culture, and even to the point where it erupts, which is the Burned Over District is right where the Erie Canal is put in. So that's the super highway of American capitalism. And like right in the land that is ripped apart, the spirits awaken. And it's also, if you think about it too, it's a time where cities are, the city is becoming a thing. And that's, if you think of it in a practical way, you need your intuition in a way that you didn't in previous. So spiritualism, it's talking about, tuning into your own psychic faculties, and also it's communion with ancestors. Every culture throughout time has that. I just find it so interesting that that's where it erupts, right near the area where the first electrified city was, which was Buffalo, and you have Niagara Falls, and you have, so whether it's literal, whether it's metaphorical, I think it's part of that's the story for sure.
Yeah, and you know what really struck me the last time I was in Lilydale and learning more about, of course, it's also the roots of the women's right movement, which is a whole other thing.
Yes.
And I was reading this book that was so interesting because it was asserting something that suddenly, when you read it, you're like, of course, that, the people in that part of the United States had daily and deep, profound relationships with the Native Americans nearby. And, when I was thinking about that from the, I mean, this is what the book was basically proposing, but I found it very convincing that, of course, that's where women's rights comes from, because they were dealing with a culture where women had rights. They were dealing with it every day. They saw one, but I think they were also dealing with a culture that still had connection, as you were saying, through shamanism, through traditional ways to the spirit world. And I wonder how much that might have impacted the culture as well.
Yeah, it's hard to know. And that is definitely, you're putting your finger on one of the point in spiritualism that's being reinterpreted and questioned on every angle. There's a lot of debate about the whole topic of Native American spirit guides.
Right.
But, there is absolutely an undeniable kinship and a lot with a lot of what spiritualism believed. And also in the newspapers, they were very interested in the rights of the Native American movement. It's hard to tell. There was a lot of different spiritualists, so it's hard to say who was doing what for who. But that said, another thing I want to make about the Native Americans, the famous one point of connection that I find really fascinating is the medium's cabinet, which is a cabinet that mediums sit in a seance room, that if you were going to do, there's different types of seances, but let's say you're going to do an ectoplasm seance, you'd want a medium's cabinet, which is like a tiny little booth. It almost looks like a Catholic confessional. But it also, there are, a number of historians who say the precursor was the shaking tent ceremony, which is when Native Americans would build this small kind of booth-like tent, and the shaman would go, or the medicine person would go in and ask questions of the spirits, and it would shake. And the medium's cabinet, it also connects to stage magic. Like, speaking of our exhibition, it's like this pinnacle point where, okay, you can see Native American culture, but you also see literally the birth of stage magic, because some of the first stage magicians were the Davenport brothers, who had their famous act was this medium's cabinet, and they would bring it on the road, and they would go on stage with the cabinet, and inside the cabinet, objects would float and all this magical stuff would happen. And it was so controversial. I was in Leeds, England at a conference, and there were historians talking about, like, when the Davenports came to Leeds, the crowds were so enraged because they would not say if they were really mediums or if they were stage magicians. And they actually broke apart the cabinet, and there were people took pieces of the cabinet for souvenirs, and they had to like get out, like run for their lives, because it was so controversial. But I think there's something really huge in that, those things all being together at once.
Yes. And that brings me to what I love in your book, Seance, the epigraph of your book. And I think it really beautifully sums up what we're talking about right now and what you were kind of alluding to earlier, the kind of binary of true and false, real and not real, which I think is so resonant in our own culture today, this challenging and this question. And I'm going to read the quote because I think it's brilliant. It's quote credited to the medium Eileen Garrett. It says, "I asked these spirit figures if I was seeing them or if I was seeing what was in my own brain. They answered both."
Yes, I love that quote.
I wonder if you could say a few. I love it too. It gives me the chills. And I think it beautifully sums up, I think, how you are able as a thinker and a photographer to stand in this space that I think is a really hard space to hold yourself in, of a kind of both and, you know, like totally addressing the challenges that skeptics might make about fraud and absurdity and the staged aspects of what you're looking at, but also something else.
Yeah, Eileen Garrett is one of my heroes in this, because she was a medium in the 20th century. She was quite famous, but she was confused about her own gifts and her own experiences. And she always remained open to the idea that maybe I'm crazy. Maybe it's spirits. Maybe it's my sensory system. You know, maybe it's a number of other things. I don't know. And one of her other quotes that I love, and I actually use this myself, is she would say, "On Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I believe in the spirit world. On Tuesday and Thursday and Saturday, I don't. And on Sundays, I don't care." And I mean, it's confusing. And sometimes I watch mediums work and I think they're playing with time or they're perceiving time in a certain way. And then other times I think, oh my God, it really feels like they're talking to my loved one or this person's loved one. And then other times I think, oh my God, this is just performance. It's very performative. And sometimes it's all in one. And so I think you have to hold the unknown in a state of questioning, and that it's not, I guess, well, you know what, I came to the decision that it's not something to be solved. It's something to like engage with. I actually see it all kind of tied to the creative forces of the universe, rather than like something we're going to trap. And, you know, there's a lot of ideas in parapsychology about trapping psychic power and making it work for you in the world, or we could tap it like electricity. But I don't know. I think it's different than that. I, you know, who knows? I could be, and again, I don't know anything. And I also am very wary of anybody who tells me they have all the answers. That's my friend.
Yeah.
So what I just, and what I love too about Eileen Garrett is that she started a foundation called the Parapsychology Foundation and hired the doctors and the scientists to study her own body. Like, wow. She was, you know, rather than like a passive, you know, there's a lot of, in this history, there's a lot of really controversial investigator versus the medium kind of situations. But she was in control of that and kind of funded the study and hired the people and put herself into it. I was able to go through some of those materials at Cambridge. They have a number of those materials that the Society of Psychical Research has their archive there at Cambridge. And also Eileen Garrett had her own foundation, and I was able to go through some of her journals. And it's just astounding to me that, you know, she really put that quote into action, meaning, you know, she kind of took that into science, that quote, like, yeah, what is it? Like, questioning the both and.
Yeah, she really lived it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That makes me wonder, hearing you talk about that, in your 25 years of going to mediums and being involved in table tippings and all sorts of other things that I know you've done, what is one of your strangest or most challenging experiences you had?
Oh, wow. I guess I have a lot. I have to say the ones that would be the most profound for me would be the one that amplifies photography's ability to transform or to trouble the reality it's supposed to be documenting. There was this one medium, and his name is Gordon Garforth, and he told me at his seance I would see his hand get really big. And I went to his seance and I actually did see his hand get really big. And to this day, I don't know what happened there. And I got my picture actually, you know, it's my picture is actually scarier than what I saw. Right. And also, I had taken a picture of him in trance, and he didn't have a mustache or glasses, but I get this picture of him And it's a time exposure where I'm using a long exposure and we're under like, I think we're shooting under like a security light. It was like this impromptu kind of situation. It's like a really long exposure, but he gets this pic. I get this picture. It's the last picture in my book of him, and he looks like he's wearing glasses and has a mustache. And then I went to his house and he showed me a picture of a carte de visite of his great grandfather, and it looks exactly like my picture. So I guess those, I have to say, are the ones that are most profound to me because they not only speak to, spiritualism's relationship with reality or this complicated relationship with truth of reality, but also photography's, and how photography can transform and invent and animate and do all these things that it's not supposed to do. Or, it wasn't, at least it wasn't revered for at first,
Yeah, I think that's so profound, and it makes me think about our, long talks about the book The Trickster and the Paranormal, and these ideas of, again, these binary dualities and the places that they are troubled, and what that says about a culture at a time when they are being troubled, right?
Yeah, so actually this project that I'm working on, it relates to the Trickster and the Paranormal book because that book is dedicated to a man named William Edward Cox, and it's the book by George Hansen. And I saved basically the archives of this seance group named Sorat, and William Edward Cox was the who Trickster and the Paranormal is dedicated to. He was the kind of in-house parapsychologist of this group. And Sorat was George Hansen's one of his first field investigations ever as a parapsychologist. And
Wow.
Sorat stands for the Society for Research on Rapport and Telekinesis. But it was a seance group that was started by the American poet John Neihardt, who wrote the book Black Elk Speaks. And again, we have this Native American connection
Right.
because Black Elk Speaks is this, it's a book, it's a co-authored book that documents the visions of a medicine man, a Lakota medicine man named Black Elk. Neihardt, it's kind of a long, crazy story, but he starts this seance group with his students at the University of Missouri, and it turns into this massive 50-year experiment. And through a number of strange events and synchronicities, I now am caretaking that archive and doing a book about that material. And this is very unexpected, and I was not expecting to be doing that. And I've been working on it for quite some time, like 5 years now,
Wow.
and I'm just at the stages where I'm getting ready to put it together as a book.
That's so exciting. And I've been lucky enough to see some of those photos. I wonder if you could just talk about some of the, because they are going back to the absurd yet tender aspect. There's just some incredible images in there. Do you want to talk just a little bit about what is in that archive?
Yeah, I guess I should preface this by saying that this group, this seance group, and these experiments and this material has crashed the boggle threshold of many minds and minds that are much more evolved than mine. And the art historian Susan Aberth, who's a friend, she described it as Poltergeist meets Stephen Shore. And I think it's just kind of like the exact, because there are these color. Post-war, they're very post-war American images of like a haunted suburbia. And
I love that.
a lot of them are these flying tables. And a lot of this material up until now, until it's been, is it true or is it false? Or they were kind of considered testimony or parapsychological artifacts or things like that. I don't see them as that now that I've been working with the material. I actually see them as an extension of Neihardt's literary cosmos. And also these tables in flight, the theme of cosmic ascent is throughout Black Elk Speaks and through Neihardt's life. And I see them as visionary art. And this is where it gets confusing because I was actually just talking to the curator Christine Bergen, and she's been a curator of conceptual art, and we were kind of talking about how the grammar of conceptual art and this spirit stuff like is very similar, like showing this absence presence. And a lot of the early photographs that we now look at as like, oh, it's this this visionary art was actually made with the intention of science. So its abstraction in photography is coming from this attempt at science, rather than, in painting, the experimental science photographers were getting to the same place as the abstract painters in this weird way. So Elaine Richards was one of the founding members, and she was the person who had the archive. And when I was talking to her about it, she didn't see them as art. She said, "We didn't fake these, and these are real images." And that's the one thing I always want you to tell people, it is that these are real, and I always believed it was real, and maybe that's why it happened. And so they would talk about it as if it was a group dream,
Whoa.
that they were like. And the term rapport in Sorat, it stands for rapport and telekinesis. It's this kind of idea of being in harmony as humans, and then you can make the impossible possible. And I think Neihardt got the term rapport from an essay on genius by Friedrich Myers, who was referring to it as kind of a form of Socratic monition, like the idea that we learn from each other. We can, when we're present together in our bodies, like this idea of being together is a type of facilitates a type of learning.
Yeah.
And even like I was listening to like the Grateful Dead guy, Phil Lesh, the bass player, and he was talking about how, oh, the Grateful Dead, when they were playing their music, they would build a group mind. And when they got in tune with each other in the group mind, then this other thing would enter. And so the way he talked about that, it was almost like made me think of the Grateful Dead as like a seance in plain sight. Like,
I think that's really interesting. I've never heard anyone talk about, in the way that you're talking about it right now, the element of human connection that's a part of a seance and that's a part of table tipping, as I know from the first time I ever went to Lilydale was on your bachelorette party. And we tried to
yeah.
table tip. And I remember I was the one who kind of got freaked out and pulled my hands back. But there's something about that group energy, right? And I just think that's super interesting. I hadn't thought about what you're talking about and that idea of rapport and that they were very consciously trying to create a situation like that.
Yeah, because with the Sorat group, they were studied endlessly, and Elaine would always say that they were treated like lab rats. You do find that in parapsychology, that because it's so criticized, they try to be
Yeah.
really extreme. Sometimes they are, these investigators are unkind to subjects. Some people argue that it's a hoax. Some people argue that no, it was totally genuine. Some people argue that it was a mix of each. Like, the thing that makes the most sense to me is that they were able to enter a group dream together. And I just love the mystery of it all, because one of the investigators said to me, when you try to start giving an explanation to all the things that happened in Sorat, psi power becomes like a better explanation than all the wacky things you come up with for everything to have, make sense in a material world.
Yeah.
And you just get lost in the weeds trying to figure it out.
Yeah, and it seems to drive people to insanity to try to go down that road often, you know? It seems like a seductive but dead-end road to try to scientifically box this stuff.
Yeah, that same investigator, his name is Dennis Stillings. He's one of the people who spent a long time studying Sorat. He said he stopped focusing on trying to prove the phenomena, and he started to try to focus on what it was doing to the people involved. And he said you could argue that it was just trying to ruin the lives of all the participants, whatever was happening in this. I think these situations like evolve, and they usually there's robust periods, and then kind of things go off the rails and get really absurd, and there's waning periods. But when they started with John Neihardt, they really believed that they were doing something noble for humanity, and that it could be as important as the invention of the wheel or bringing fire to, they were trying to get like real knowledge from metaphysical reality to bring into our world to make it a better place. And so they really had noble goals. And that's one of the things I love about the project, is everything is so proper and done in the spirit of friendship. And there's nothing, it's very like candy colored domestic magic. magical realism. I don't know. It's a really, I find the material extremely exciting.
Yeah. And one thing I've always loved about your work is you have such respect for the material, even though you can acknowledge its absurd elements, you do so with love, you know, and I think that's really evident in how you present the material and how your work can be looked at and appreciated by skeptics and art historians and spiritualists. And I think what you're doing is just incredible.
Oh, thank you so much. You're welcome. I have to really, I developed so much of it with Morbid Anatomy, with doing those talks. And it's really what made me become a researcher.
Oh, thank you, Shannon. And it's been such a delight to be talking to you.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
I want to end with 3 questions I'm going to ask all my guests just to bring it back to some of our core themes. Has your work changed your thoughts about death and what happens after?
I had to read a lot about the near-death experience because of all this, and I don't understand how you can't find that material compelling. And, you know, when I listen to that, I'm a lot less afraid of death, too. You know, I love Raymond Moody, who is the man who coined the term near-death experience. And I just think he's a wonderful writer, and his books are just really worthwhile, all of them, and the way he thinks about this. And he was talking about a near-death experience more recently, and it was like a woman who, she had been a Broadway actress, and she had played the same role like for 30 years. And after she had ended that role, she had a near-death experience. It wasn't related, but she said, it was the same feeling as when I left that stage and I knew I was not going to be that person anymore or like that had gone. She said, that's exactly what it was like. And I just thought, oh my God, that's so profound. And you know how acting, I'm really interested in acting, how acting is so important to us. And I do think that said so much to me, just hearing that one. But all of the I think near-death experiences are the whole story of that. And if you really look into that material, it's incredibly compelling. And just even that aspect alone has really changed the way I think about it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I'm also wondering if in any conscious or unconscious way you think questions about death was animating this body of work at all.
I mean, I guess it was, because it was, could my grandfather really tell us something from the grave? And what role do the dead have in our lives of the living? You know, you have some cultures think it's bad luck, but yet there is ancestor worship. So what's the appropriate relationship? I mean, the main question that spurred me on the path relates to that directly, which is like, can this be happening? And if it is, what does it mean?
Yeah. Okay. My final question is, if you could live forever, would you? And why or why not?
No.
I know. No. Me too. That's how I feel too. But a lot of people really want to. I was just curious.
Because death makes life meaningful. You're limited time. It's now or never, you know. Yeah. This life would not be the same thing if that was the case. I don't know. I just think it really is something you should keep in your mind at all times and not get away from. And it's important to think about.
Well, I'm, as you know, 1,000% on board with that and absolutely agree. Yes. Shannon, thank you so much for being here with us today. It was so wonderful to talk to you formally about your work. And we'll be putting in the show notes links to Shannon's work. So I definitely encourage people to go look at these images. We've talked about a lot of images, but without seeing them, it's really hard to understand. And I'm so excited to see where your Surratt project goes.
Thank you.
Okay, so now that we have finished our interview, I wanted to bring in the producer of this show, Jess, so we could discuss and see what she thought about it. So Jess, was there anything that stood out to you about that interview? Something that was new, exciting, challenging?
Yeah, I found it all really fascinating. So in addition to producing this podcast. I love this stuff and I listen to it. I'm a very spooky girl. And yeah, it was just so interesting hearing about Shannon's experience and the kind of the history behind the spirit photography. And tell me about that bachelor party.
Bachelorette party. It was amazing. I mean, she brought her mom, her sister, and a bunch of her friends. We all flew up from New York City to Lilydale. We engaged in message circles, which is when you bring a medium in and you try to bring in the spirits of the dead for messages to other people in the group. We made our own little fairy houses, which is a tradition they have there, where they have this little wooded walk where people make these little houses for fairies. And we tried to engage in table tipping. And some people went to their own mediums as well. I did too. And I actually had no good experiences. I didn't have any mind-blowing experiences the way some people did.
Did you have any messages come to you in the group session?
Nothing that felt meaningful, no.
Interesting. Yeah. Have you been to a seance before?
No, I don't think so. I think that was really my first experience with that kind of stuff. And I have to say, at that point in my life, I was really skeptical. And I think when you're really skeptical, nothing happens. It really is. There's something about being open and being having a reciprocal relationship that is what allows for people to have experiences. And I was not in that state.
Yeah. Do you know, someone told me that recently. I went to my first seance last month and it was an interesting experience. But the person leading it did say it is about how open you are to these things in terms of what you get out of it. It felt like a really mindful exercise, actually, the whole process of the seance, and it felt really blissed out for a couple of days afterwards. I wonder how it affects Shannon, actually, you know, in terms of being present in them, even if she's not an active participant, you know, but being there and recording it. I wonder how much of that energy she ends up absorbing.
Yeah. Well, she did mention that it's not unlike a psychedelic experience, so I have to feel there's something that she's getting there.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have a favorite piece of spirit photography?
Oh, I'm not good with favorites. All of it. Highly recommend that listeners go out and take a look, because there's no words that can express how these things feel when you look at them. But there was a wonderful exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art called The Perfect Medium, where they showed a bunch of those for the first time. And if you can find that catalog, that's a great introduction.
That sounds great. I also really want to look into the image that Shannon was saying about with the giant hand.
That is in her book, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, there's something really intriguing about that. And the experience of a seance where that she did the exposure and had the two heads as well. That's a great story, I thought.
It's a great image too.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and our happenings, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also find us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, or check out our Substack at morbidanatomy.substack.com.
Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week, we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.